Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. For the next 2 weeks, Pardes is bringing Purim to you. Let's dive in.
This is Nechama Goldman Barish coming to you from Jerusalem. The chapter now continues with a series of Mishnayot that all begin with, "There is no difference between A and B except C," known as Ein Bein in rabbinic parlance. Thematically, there is no connection between the 13 examples, except for the use of this phraseology. Only the first one, which I taught in the second podcast in the series, was directly relevant to our topic of Megillah and Purim, with the Mishnah that read, "There is no difference between the first Adar and the second Adar, except for the reading of the Megillah and distributing gifts to the poor, which are performed in the second Adar and not the first." The series, which are linked methodologically through this shared phrase, will expose us to a wide variety of subjects that are reflective of the way rabbinic text study interlinks vastly different topics, bundling them together into this structure of oral Torah. Let us begin with the Mishnah that we're going to study, the first Mishnah we're going to study in this podcast. Ein bein yom tov l'shabbat, ela ochel nefesh bilvad. There is no difference between Shabbat and the festival except for preparing food. There are actually many differences between Shabbat and Yom Tov, or festivals. These include Sukkot and Passover and Rosh Hashanah, even with regard to what work is permitted on Yom Tov that is prohibited on Shabbat. However, this phraseology allows for a sharpened focus on one major difference, which is the preparation of food. This would include slaughtering an animal, skinning it, and preparing it for cooking or roasting, mixing flour and water into a dough, kneading it, allowing it to rise, and baking it, and so on and so forth. A famous difference of opinion is how far food preparation is extended with regard to permitting certain types of work. Beit Shammai limits it only to direct food preparation. Beit Hillel, in contrast, rule that whatever categories of labor are permitted for food preparation are also permitted for other necessities. For instance, since carrying food is permitted for food preparation, Beit Hillel permits one to carry a child, a lulav, or a Torah scroll on Yom Tov if needed for use on the festival. Another famous argument is around the preliminaries to food preparation. If one forgot to prepare a knife, could one go as far as forging a knife in order to slaughter the animal? The majority opinion prohibits preliminaries that could have been done ahead of time. The minority opinion permits even this in the name of food preparation. Moving on to the second half of this Mishnah, Ein bein Shabbat liyom kippurim, ela shezez dono bidei adam, vizez dono bekaret. The difference between Shabbat and Yom Kippur, or there is no difference between Shabbat and Yom Kippur, except that for one, its intentional desecration is punishable at the hand of man. We'll see what that means in a moment. And in the other case, its intentional desecration is punishable at the hand of God with karet. While there are other differences between Yom Kippur and Shabbat, eating being the obvious one, the Mishnah is focusing on the subject of malacha or labor and reminding the reader that malacha is equally prohibited on both days, in contrast to festival days when it could be permitted for food preparation. And that was the earlier part of the Mishnah that we already studied together. The difference, states the Mishnah, is in the punishment. Deliberately violating Shabbat leads to stoning by the court, while deliberate desecration of Yom Kippur is punishable with karet, which literally means to be cut off, although the rabbis understood it to mean a divinely imposed premature death. Moving on to the next example in the Mishnah. Another example of this Ein Bein structure involves two bodily states of tumah, roughly translated as impurity, but really a state in which a person cannot bring a sacrifice in the temple until he cycles through the process called tahara, roughly translated as purity. So here's the language of the Mishnah. Ein bein zav haroesh shtei ri'iyot l'roesh shalosh ela korban. There is no difference between a zav, a man who has a pus-like discharge from his sexual organ, called zivut, two emissions, right? So there's no difference between the Zav who has two emissions of discharge from his sexual organ and one who experiences three emissions, except that the Zav who has three emissions has to bring a sacrifice or a korban in order to complete his purification process. While the Zav with two emissions already incurs a moderate form of tum'ah, it is only with the third that he fully becomes what is called a Zav and is required to go through a complete process of tahara, which includes bringing sacrifices. Interesting observation is based on a question in the Gemara. What creates chazaka, or an established pattern? Is it the second or third repetition of an act or occurrence? The majority opinion determines that it is the third time that the same thing happens that turns something temporary into something expected and more permanent. Here, too, the first and second time a man experiences an unnatural emission, it might be happenstance, but the third time, it's already a pattern, and his status is transformed from tahor to quasi-tameh to fully tameh. And this is something that plays out in other areas of halacha when three times creates the chazaka, and then that is something that is expected also in terms of a halachic requirement. Moving on to the second half of the same Mishnah, Ein bein mitzora muzgar lemitzora muchlat ela priya uprima. There is no difference between a quarantined leper and a confirmed leper, except for letting the hair grow wild and rending one's garment. So let me give a little bit of a background. A person who is suspected of having tzara'at, which is translated as leprosy, but that's not really accurate. It's not the disease we call leprosy. It's a term for a skin affliction that we don't really recognize today in terms of modern science and medicine, but it was certainly known in the time of the Bible. And one was who was suspected of leprosy was examined by a priest who, if he found his symptoms to be inconclusive, would put him in isolation for a period of up to 2 weeks waiting to see if further symptoms developed. A mitzora muchlat, or a confirmed leper, was one whose symptoms were conclusive and the priest had declared him absolutely a mitzora, an absolute leper, and he would have to let his hair grow wild and tear his garments. So a quarantine leper does not have to do that. A confirmed leper does have to do that. So what we have is questionable mitzora, confirmed mitzora. Both are removed from the camp and quarantined for a period of time. And the confirmed mitzora, as we said, has to follow the instructions written in the Torah. I'm now going to read the verse. And the person in whom there is the affliction, his garment shall be torn, the hair of his head shall be unshorn, and he shall cloak himself up to his lips and call out, Tameh, Tameh. These requirements apply only to the confirmed mitzora, not to the confined one. In today's day and age, we can certainly relate to this Mishnah. Exposure to someone with COVID puts a person into quarantine for 2 weeks, unless symptoms develop, in which case he now becomes confirmed with COVID. And perhaps we should write our own Ein Bein. There is no difference between suspected COVID and confirmed COVID, except for the days of isolation, which in parentheses are actually shorter if you have confirmed COVID, along with the definite presence of antibodies if you have had COVID. It is certainly interesting how a Mishnah about Tzara'at that on the face of it is totally irrelevant and suddenly seem relevance and meaning for our own lives when you look at it through the lens of certain events that are going on right now in contemporary experience. The last Mishnah we're going to look at is the eighth Mishnah in chapter 1. Ein bein svarim l'tfilin u'mezuzot, ela sh'asvarim nichtavim b'chol lashon, u'tfilin u'mezuzot einan nichtavot ela ashurit. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, af b'svarim lo hitiru sh'yikatvu ela yevanit. So there's no difference between Torah scrolls and tfilin, phylacteries, and mezuzot, except that Torah scrolls can be written in any language, whereas tefillin and mezuzot are written only in Ashurit, meaning in Hebrew script. The Gemara asks, with regard to tefillin and mezuzot, what is the reason they have to be written in Hebrew? And the Gemara explains because it says, Vayu hadvarim ha'ela, because it is written with these words, or these words shall be, that limits the writing on the parchment in the Tefillin and Mezuzot to Hebrew script. The second half of the Mishnah, which we have not yet translated, is the position of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who says with regard to Torah scrolls, the only language they can be permitted to be written in is Greek. The Tanakhama, the first Tana, had said that they could be written in any language. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel limits it to Greek, otherwise they will not have the sanctity of a Torah scroll. The Gemara following this Mishnah tells the story of the Targum Shivim, or the Greek translation of the Torah, organized by King Ptolemy of Egypt, who collected 72 sages, hence Targum Shivim, the translation of the 70, and put them in separate rooms and commanded them to begin translating the Torah. According to rabbinic tradition, all of these men heard a heavenly voice that helped them translate the Torah in the same way, including passages that could have been misunderstood had they been rendered in a literal fashion. Initially, the Targum Shivim was the first translation of the Torah into a foreign language, an occurrence that the sages viewed at first as dangerous at best. After a time, however, the translation was accepted as important and valuable and was treated with respect by the sages. The Jews of Egypt in particular viewed the Targum Shivim, known as the Septuagint, with great reverence and saw its creation as one of holiness. Aside from the record of the event that appears in rabbinic literature, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz brings a brief summary of the letter of Aristeas, an ancient Greek letter which describes the king's initiative to have the Torah translated and the greatness of the sages who were brought from Israel to carry it out. What is notable is the Tanakhama allowing the books of Tanakh, of scripture, to be written in any language, in contrast to mezuzah and tefillin, which are holy articles that are used in worship. And the meaning of the text, or understanding the meaning of the text, as part of this worship, is really unnecessary. The books of scripture, however, must be read and understood by those who read them and believe in them. This suggests a democratization of the text in allowing translations into multiple languages, giving access to one and all to the holy words of the Torah. Today we see an explosion in the learning of the Daf Yomi cycle of Talmud because of the excellent translations into many languages, notably Hebrew, English, French, and partially already in Spanish. Easy access of ancient texts into languages that can be understood today indeed maintains our reputation as people of the book. Thank you for listening. See you next time.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty. And a big thanks to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in every day to stay on track with your learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about other ways to learn with Pardes.